Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 15, Shadrach Minkins and the Fugitive Slave Law. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. And this week, we're going to continue our celebration of Black History Month. In light of recent actions taken by the executive branch of our government and the nationwide protests against them, we thought this would be a good time to revisit a time in which Boston resisted an unjust law. After Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, abolitionists in Boston felt that the values of Southern slavers were being forced upon a free city. In 1851, Shadrach Minkins was the first fugitive to be arrested in Boston, but before he could be returned to slavery, a multiracial mob stormed the courtroom and forcibly delivered him to the Underground Railroad. But before we meet Shadrach Minkins, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is February 6th, and that's the anniversary of the blizzard of 1978. The winter of 2015 might have brought us the highest snowfall total of all time, but the blizzard of 78 remains legendary. Boston got about 27 inches of snow, the second highest amount of snowfall in a single storm, by half an inch. And forecasting technology wasn't nearly as advanced in those days. The forecast had called for a big storm to strike on Monday morning, but when it didn't come, many Bostonians chalked it up to just another bad weather report. When the storm began in earnest that afternoon, people began streaming home from work, and the roads became gridlocked at rush hour. The snowplows, which were already struggling to keep up with the blizzard, became mired in traffic, and really ineffective as the snow began to fall at a rate of 2 inches per hour. Major highways were closed by accidents and drifting snow, and 14 people were killed by carbon monoxide poisoning in their idling cars on Route 128. Houses on the north and south shore were pummeled by hurricane-force wind and waves. In the end, the storm is blamed for taking 100 lives through carbon monoxide poisoning, car accidents, children suffocating in snowbanks, and even a shipwreck. It would take weeks for the region to dig out and return to normal.
On February 7, 1784, the Massachusetts Bank was incorporated in Boston. It was the young country's first independent bank, independent of the influence of the Bank of England, that is. Early account holders included Paul Revere, John Hancock, and Henry Knox, and the bank provided financing that helped open up America's early trading contacts with China. Since 1784, the bank's been through many transitions, becoming the First National Bank of Boston, then Bank Boston, then Fleet Bank, and then in 2004, becoming part of the Bank of America. Now, Hamilton fans probably know the famous line from the musical, "John Adams doesn't have a real job anyway."
Angelica, tell this man, John Adams spends the summer with his family.
Angelica, tell my wife, John Adams doesn't have a real job anyway.
That, of course, was referring to his role as vice president, and Adams would have largely agreed. Throughout his 2 terms as VP, he was terminally bored with the position. On February 8, 1794, he wrote to Abigail with his thoughts on the vice presidency and his usual romantic feelings for his wife. "Congress have been together more than 2 months and have done nothing, and will continue sitting 2 months longer and do little. I, for my part, am wearied to death with ennui. Obliged to be punctual by my habits, confined to my seat as in a prison, to see nothing done, hear nothing said, and to say and do nothing. Oh, that my rocks were here within a mile or two, and my little habitation, and pretty, pretty little wife above all. I fear that some fault unknown has brought upon me such punishments, to be separated both when we were too young and when we are too old."
Thursday is February 9th, and on February 9th, 1775, Parliament proclaimed that Massachusetts was in rebellion, saying, "We find that a part of your Majesty's subjects in the province of the Massachusetts Bay have proceeded so far to resist the authority of the Supreme Legislature that a rebellion at this time actually exists within the said province, and we see, with the utmost concern, that they have been countenanced and encouraged by unlawful combinations and engagements, entered into by your Majesty's subjects in several of the other colonies, to the injury and oppression of many of their innocent fellow subjects resident within the Kingdom of Great Britain and the rest of your Majesty's dominions." The unlawful combinations and engagements refer to the Massachusetts Provincial Congress and the Second Continental Congress, which would become a real thorn in Parliament's side when war broke out 2 months later. Phyllis Wheatley was an enslaved woman who had been brought to Boston as a child, then rose to fame as a poet. In the fall of 1775, after George Washington had taken command of the Patriot Army around Boston, Phyllis dedicated a poem to him, sending him a copy in October. The final lines were, "Proceed, great chief, with virtue on thy side. Thy every action let the goddess guide. A crown, a mansion, and a throne that shine, with gold unfading, Washington, be thine." Washington, a slave owner himself, took some time to read and think about the poem. Finally, on February 10th, 1776, he wrote back to her with his thanks, saying, "I thank you most sincerely for your polite notice of me. In the elegant lines you enclosed, and as a tribute justly due to you, I would have published the poem had I not been apprehensive that, while I only meant to give the world this new instance of your genius, I might have incurred the imputation of vanity. This, and nothing else, determined me not to give it place in the public prints." He also extended an invitation for her to visit his headquarters, but if she took him up on his offer, there's no record of it. Wheatley, the internationally renowned poet, would be released from slavery only upon her owner's death in 1778. We'll have a link to Washington's full letter in the show notes for this week's episode, as well as her complete poem.
Saturday is February 11th, and that's the date in 1812 when the term gerrymander was coined. Gerrymandering is a term that describes one political party manipulating the boundaries of political districts in a way that creates an advantage for their candidates. Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry had signed a law redrawing several Massachusetts districts into what some considered strange shapes, one of which might have resembled a lizard or a salamander. Poor Elbridge Gerry was a Massachusetts delegate to the Second Continental Congress, he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and he was vital to convincing other delegates to sign. He was a delegate also to the Constitutional Convention. He was the governor of Massachusetts, and later he would become the vice president of the United States. However, thanks to a political cartoon that ran in the Boston Gazette on February 11, 1812, his name will forever be linked to partisan redistricting schemes. We'll have a link to that famous cartoon and this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/015.
Finally, Sunday is February 12th, and on February 12th, 1775, Patriot leader Joseph Warren wrote to his associate with a fateful prediction. "I am of opinion that, if once General Gage should lead his troops into the country with design to enforce the late acts of Parliament, Great Britain may take her leave, at least of the New England colonies, and, if I mistake not, of all America. If there is any wisdom in the nation, God grant it may be speedily called forth. Every day, every hour widens the breach." Of course, on April 19th, General Gage led his troops into the country, leading to the battles at Lexington and Concord and the onset of the Revolution. Warren would die at Bunker Hill in June, and the 13 colonies would declare their independence the following July. We'll link to the full text of the letter in this week's show notes.
Our story this week opens in 1850, in the midst of one of the most politically polarized atmospheres this country's ever seen, at least until now. The framers of our Constitution left the question of slavery unanswered, and a series of increasingly complicated compromises were contrived to try to keep the country from tearing itself apart. First, in 1820, Massachusetts sacrificed a large portion of its territory to create the new independent state of Maine. Maine had to be created as a free state to offset the admission of the new slave state, Missouri. This allowed the balance of power in Congress to remain equal between slave and free states, at a time when both sides were threatening secession if the other gained the upper hand. The Missouri Compromise also drew a line in the sand at 36 degrees 30 minutes north, stating that no new slave states could be admitted north of that line. However, the stability lawmakers hoped to gain with this compromise was short-lived, and by 1850, trouble was brewing again. Henry Clay and other lawmakers put together another compromise, a complicated dance that admitted new states to the Union and pushed through related legislation. You might recall Henry Clay from last week's episode as the man who sold Lewis Hayden's first wife and son down the river. Despite the best efforts of Congress, the sectional tensions between slave and free states kept building this time, until the country finally tore itself apart in civil war.
The Compromise of 1850 had a lot of moving parts. Texas, a huge anchor of slave power, agreed to give up territory that would later be part of New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas, and Oklahoma. In return, the federal government assumed millions of dollars in debt that Texas had run up while trying and failing to operate as an independent state. California, rich with newly discovered Gold Rush gold, was admitted to the Union as a free state. New Mexico and Utah territories were organized, and again Congress kicked the can of slavery down the road, leaving the question to be decided by each territory at a later date. Slave trading was banned in Washington, D.C., but anyone who was already enslaved in the city was left in bondage. The ban on slave trading in Washington is the height of political window dressing, since the small city was surrounded on all sides by the slave states of Maryland and Virginia. The final measure that representatives of slave power pushed through Congress as part of this compromise was a new Fugitive Slave Act. A previous fugitive slave law had been in effect since 1793, but Massachusetts and other free states had found many ways to resist the existing law. The new law, which was championed by Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster as a means of saving the Union, was much harsher, and Shadrach Minkins would be one of the first high-profile victims.
Shadrach Minkins was born into slavery in Virginia sometime around 1815. As with many enslaved people, not much is known about his early life. We know that he lived his entire life until he was about 30 years old in and around the port city of Norfolk, Virginia. We know that he was sold to a new owner in 1849. In the show notes this week, we'll link to a newspaper advertisement listing him for sale along with other enslaved people who are owned by Martha Hutchings and Edward DeCormis.
One of the interesting things we can glean from that ad is that it references a writ of fieri fascius. That's a legal instrument that allows a sheriff to seize and sell the property belonging to someone who had lost a lawsuit or had a judgment against them.
So Shadrach's previous owners had lost some sort of suit or judgment, and they were in such dire straits that the sheriff had to seize their property, including human property, to sell at auction and pay off their debts. One biographer speculates from that admittedly slim evidence that Minkins may have had a strained relationship with his new owner, John DeBrie. We have no way of knowing what his new life was like or what was happening in that household, but we do know that soon after that sale, Shadrach Minkins decided to risk everything and attempt to liberate himself from bondage. Again, there's very little evidence to show us how he made that happen, but by May of 1850, Shadrach Minkins had found his way to Boston. He probably came by ship, either as a stowaway or by finding a sympathetic northern captain who would agree to let him work for his passage north.
After his arrival, Minkins made a life in Boston. He worked in a coffee house on Cornhill Street, which was one of the streets that ran through what is now City Hall Plaza. He waited tables and, by all accounts, enjoyed his freedom. Relatively quickly, he felt pretty comfortable in his adopted home. By this time, Boston had a well-deserved reputation for resisting slave catchers. By 1841, abolitionists had formed a group called the Boston Vigilance Committee, which vowed to protect escaped slaves from slave catchers and bounty hunters who might try to kidnap them in Boston. The committee was composed of black and white members, with leaders like Reverend Theodore Parker and Lewis Hayden. The Vigilance Committee raised funds and provided legal counsel, but also pledged to physically stop any enslavement they saw, arming themselves with weighted wooden cudgels. And you can find a picture of an abolitionist group's cudgels in the show notes for this week's episode. By 1843, the Massachusetts legislature passed a Personal Liberty Act. Known as the Latimer Law after George Latimer, the escaped slave who inspired the law, it prevented any Massachusetts officials from complying with slave hunters. Our law enforcement agents would not detain suspected fugitives, and our jails couldn't be used to hold them. No sheriff, deputy sheriff, coroner, constable, jailer, or other official of this commonwealth shall hereafter arrest or detain or aid in the arrest or detention or imprisonment in any jail or any other building belonging to this commonwealth or any county, city, or town thereof, of any person for the reason that he is claimed as a fugitive slave. It made all of Massachusetts into the 19th century equivalent of a sanctuary city. We'll link to the full text of the law in the show notes at hubhistory.com/015.
With such a strong abolitionist heritage behind him, it's no wonder Minkins was comfortable enough to work in a very public job like waiting tables in a coffee shop less than a block from the city's federal courthouse. Unfortunately for him, though, the Fugitive Slave Act was signed into law by President Fillmore on September 18, 1850. It implemented steep federal penalties for any officials in a free state who refused to do everything in their power to capture a fugitive, effectively overturning the Latimer Law in Massachusetts. It went even further, though, stripping away the rights of an accused fugitive to get a jury trial. This meant that even free African Americans could be kidnapped into slavery on nothing more than the word of a slave catcher, with no legal recourse to defend themselves, even if they'd been born and lived their entire lives as free men. This would lead to the complete undermining of trust in institutions like the police and courts, as seen in an 1851 placard that was posted around Boston, which read, "Caution! Colored people of Boston, one and all, you are hereby respectfully cautioned and advised to avoid conversing with the watchmen and police officers of Boston. For since the recent order of the mayor and aldermen, they are empowered to act as kidnappers and slave catchers, and they have already been actually employed in kidnapping, catching, and keeping slaves. Therefore, if you value your liberty and the welfare of the fugitives among you, shun them in every possible manner, as so many hounds on the track of the most unfortunate of your race. Keep a sharp lookout for kidnappers and have top eye open." With federal law on his side, a slave hunter from Norfolk, Virginia named John Caphart arrived in Boston in early February with an affidavit from Minkins' owner John DeBrie. In keeping with the new law, all he had to do was identify Shadrach Minkins, get a warrant for his arrest, and bring him before a judge. Minkins would have no standing to challenge his return to slavery. All Caphart had to do was keep it quiet, so Boston's notorious Vigilance Committee and other abolitionists wouldn't try to block him. On February 15, 1851, U.S. Marshal Patrick Riley and two agents met at the coffee shop with an arrest warrant for Shadrach Minkins. While they waited for Caphart to arrive and identify the fugitive, their waiter brought them coffee. Ironically, the waiter was Minkins himself. When he stepped out for just a moment, Minkins ran into a group of agents who were waiting outside. In the confusion, they seized him and rushed him out the back of the coffee shop toward the federal courthouse across State Street. Shadrach didn't fight them, but he also didn't go quietly. By this time, it was a busy Saturday afternoon on one of the busiest streets in town, and a crowd gathered quickly as Minkins was dragged into the courthouse.
As the crowd around the courthouse grew, a number of attorneys offered their services to help Minkins, including Richard Henry Dana Jr., Samuel E. Sewell, and Robert Morris. However, with the rights of an accused slave curtailed by federal law, there was little they could do but stall for time. As a last-ditch effort, they filed a writ of habeas corpus with the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, trying to force a judgment on whether federal authorities had the right to detain Minkins. Unfortunately, Chief Justice Lemuel Shaw refused the petition. The delays, however, gave the Vigilance Committee time to organize and act. By this time, there were hundreds of people packing the hallway and stairwells outside the courtroom. Every time the door opened to let a lawyer or a court officer come or go, the crowds outside would yell for answers, clutching at the door, which an officer would then pull closed against the crowd. Finally, as the door opened to let attorney Charles G. Davis and a newspaper reporter leave the courtroom, a shout came from outside. "Boys, are you ready? It's now or never." Some witnesses would later testify that it was Lewis Hayden himself who cried out and led the mob into the courtroom. but he would contest that fact. About 20 African-American men managed to pull the door open and stormed into the courtroom. They overpowered the officer who was manning the door, who would later say, "Blows were passed at me, and some kicks." He heard a voice in the crowd say, "Knife him," but an older man replied, "No, hurt no one." The group bodily seized Minkins, grabbing him up by the collar and the feet, and ran him out the door. The crowds outside were jubilant. They swarmed around Shadrach Minkins, patting his shoulders, congratulating him, and conveniently preventing the U.S. Marshals inside the courthouse from pursuing him. Finally, Lewis Hayden pulled Minkins away from the crowd and rushed him to Beacon Hill, where Minkins was initially hidden in a neighbor's attic. As night fell, Hayden escorted him across the river to Cambridge, and then that night a carriage would deliver him to an Underground Railroad stop in Concord. From Concord, he was passed to allies in Fitchburg, and from there he was taken to Canada.
Shadrach Minkins would live out his life in Montreal. He worked at first as a waiter, and then tried his hand at operating a restaurant himself. He was far from the only formerly enslaved person to wind up living in freedom in Canada. He settled himself amongst the community of former fugitives, married, and raised a family. His last career was as a barber, an occupation that was common among Montreal's free black community. He never returned to the U.S., not even after emancipation, eventually passing away in Montreal on December 13, 1875. In the wake of the rescue, federal officials insisted on prosecuting those who had been involved. 9 leading abolitionists were arrested, and 7 ended up facing charges, 5 African-Americans and 2 whites. Lewis Hayden was among the first of the 7 trials to take place in Boston's federal courthouse. In the end, prosecutors couldn't obtain a single conviction. Despite the huge crowds of witnesses who had been in and around the courthouse at the time of the rescue, Lewis Hayden was acquitted. In the show notes, we'll link to a letter one of Hayden's attorneys wrote to a supporter asking for testimony that Hayden was not the leader of the courtroom mob. And in it, there's a clipping with a sample of the testimony against him. The liberation of Shadrach Minkins was a great victory for the Vigilance Committee and Boston abolitionists. However, it also provoked a strong backlash from federal officials and even Bostonians who were either pro-slavery or at least willing to live with slavery in exchange for stability. Within days, the Boston Daily Times ran the headline, "Overthrow of the White Power and the Establishment of the Black Empire of Massachusetts." President Millard Fillmore was enraged. He felt that the Compromise of 1850 was barely holding the country together, and now these abolitionists in Boston threatened to upset the apple cart. He issued a proclamation on February 18th saying, "Whereas information has been received that sundry lawless persons, principally persons of color, combined and confederated together for the purpose of opposing by force the execution of the laws of the United States, now therefore, to the end that the authority of the laws may be maintained and those concerned in violating them brought to immediate and condign punishment, I have issued this, my proclamation, calling on all well-disposed citizens to rally to the support of the laws of their country and requiring and commanding all officers, civil and military, and all other persons, civil or military, who shall be found within the vicinity of this outrage to be aiding and assisting by all means in their power in quelling this and other such combinations."
Even more than his angry proclamation, President Fillmore's final word on Shadrach Minkins was a vow to use the U.S. military to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act against Bostonians in the future. And he wouldn't have to wait long. Just 2 months later, a young man named Thomas Sims was arrested by slave catchers in Boston. The Vigilance Committee tried to rescue him following the same playbook as the Shadrach Minkins rescue, but the story ends with U.S. Marines marching a shackled Sims to the Boston waterfront and putting him on a ship bound back to slavery. We'll have that story and more in next week's episode.
Okay, if you want to learn more about Lewis Hayden, the Boston Vigilance Committee, or the rescue of Shadrach Minkins, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/015. We'll have a copy of Daniel Webster's notes for his famous 7th of March speech in favor of the Fugitive Slave Act. We'll also have that 1849 newspaper advertisement offering Shadrach Minkins for sale. the full text of the Massachusetts Personal Liberty Law, and the letters seeking testimony in favor of Lewis Hayden. Speaking of Lewis Hayden, make sure to go back and listen to last week's episode, if you haven't already. A listener named P.A. Johnson reached out after last week's episode and said, "Thank you for including Delia Webster in Lewis Hayden's story," and also included a link to more information on abolitionist Delia Webster. You can find that on our Facebook page.
If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/hubhistory, and our Twitter handle is @hubhistory. You can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com, or go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. We'd love to read your feedback on the show. Or, if you're as worried as we are about the next step this administration will take, drop us a line and tell us where to sign up for the 21st century version of the Vigilance Committee.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about Thomas Sims and Anthony Burns and the federal government's imposition of slave power over the city of Boston.